I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. Welcome to the second of a special two-part Real Talk MS series highlighting conversations with past recipients of the Borancic Prize for Innovation in Multiple Sclerosis Research. The Borancic Prize is awarded by the Charles and Marjorie Borancic Foundation. The Borancic family had been touched by MS, and Charles and Marjorie Borancic believed that one creative and driven individual could accelerate the work that would bring us closer to a world without MS. The Borancic Prize is $100,000 to be used at the discretion of the recipient, and it's presented each year at the annual meeting of the America's Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis, a meeting better known as the ACTRIMS Forum. Several past Borancic Prize winners gathered at the 2023 ACTRIMS Forum to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Borancic Prize, and I took that opportunity to chat with this remarkable group of research all-stars to explore what innovation in MS research meant to each of them and find out what recent MS research excited them most about the future. In today's episode, we're talking to the 2018, 2020, and 2022 Borancic Prize winners. In 2018, Dr. Katerina Akasoglu of the Gladstone Institute of Neurological Disease was awarded the Borancic Prize for her work understanding the role of fibrin-related nerve damage in MS and designing potential therapies to prevent neurodegeneration. In a moment, we'll meet Dr. Akasoglu. Professor Katerina Akasoglu is a senior investigator at the Gladstone Institute of Neurological Disease and a professor of neurology at the University of California, San Francisco. She's also the 2018 recipient of the Borancic Prize for Innovation in MS Research, awarded in recognition of her breakthrough research in understanding the origins of nerve damage in MS and identifying potential therapies to stop it. Professor Akasoglu's lab has uncovered new mechanisms that control the communication between the brain, the immune system, and the vascular system. Professor Akasoglu and her team pioneered studies showing that when the blood-brain barrier is disrupted, the blood clotting factor, fibrinogen, can leak into the brain where it induces neurodegeneration. These findings indicate that fibrinogen leakage could contribute to a wide range of neurologic conditions, including multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's disease, traumatic brain injury, and stroke. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Akasoglu.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
We're here at the ACTRIMS Forum in part to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Borancic Prize, an award that recognizes innovation in MS research. How do you define the term innovation in MS research? What does that mean to you?
Innovation, I think, in the multiple sclerosis research is being able to think outside the box and sometimes connect the dots in seemingly unrelated processes, because this can lead to big discoveries that help us identify the drivers of disease and also develop new drugs to be able to stop these pathogenic processes in the brain in multiple sclerosis.
One of the goals of the Pathways to Cures Global Research Initiative is to stop MS. What do you think about when you hear that? And I guess, more importantly, how might we get there?
Yes, I think stopping MS, the pathway to cure, is a very important goal, as there are multiple toxic processes in the brain that occur in the context of multiple sclerosis that affect neuronal cells, synaptic activity, but also stop repair processes in the brain. So how to get there? I think finding the drivers in the multiple sclerosis brain that polarize these immune cells towards these toxic phenotypes that cause oxidative stress and become neurotoxic or can stop the repair of myelinating cells. I think this is really important to neutralize the toxicity of these drivers to be able to stop these neurotoxic processes in the multiple sclerosis brain.
You're also the co-founder of MetaRed, a company that's focused on developing potential therapies based on your research. Can you tell me a little more about the work that MedaRed is involved in and its potential impact on people living with MS and other neurologic conditions?
Yes, so I founded a university spin-out. Originally, the name was MedaRed, now it's Therini Bio. In the course of the research in our lab, what we found is that a blood protein in the brain, blood clotting factor, was a key driver to activate toxic immune responses and promote neurodegeneration. And the challenge was this clotting factor had a very beneficial function in hemostasis. So the challenge was, how can we neutralize only its toxicity in the brain, but without affecting its beneficial effects in hemostasis? So I developed in the lab a first-in-class immunotherapy to selectively neutralize the toxicity of this blood protein in the brain, but without affecting its beneficial functions in clotting. So with the help of the university, I spun out Therini Bio to be able to humanize the antibody that I had developed in the lab to make it appropriate for human use. And also take it towards clinical translation.
I think sometimes some of my listeners think about research as being in one silo, and then the therapies that are available to them in a very different silo, perhaps not even close together. How does it feel to see your work moving from the lab into what could be life-changing therapeutics for people living with MS?
Yes, I think basic research and discovery is what I do. But for our research, I think to eventually have impact, we always have to think about the clinical translation. And I think helping this step, I think, is really important for patients and for us to be able to see how our findings can move into towards clinical development. For me, of course, it's extremely gratifying to be able to identify this target over now 20 years ago, and to see that it's gradually moving towards the clinic.
In introducing you, I reminded my listeners that you were the 2018 recipient of the Brancic Prize. When you think about MS research over the 5 years since then, is there anything that especially comes to mind, something that really stands out in your mind?
In the past 5 years, I think we have had tremendous progress in MS research. In my program, one of the two things that I'm the most excited about is, first, integration of new technologies, how much more we have learned about the brain immune vascular communication by new cutting-edge technologies that we're able to integrate to understand multiple sclerosis, but also for discoveries that link regeneration in MS with drivers of toxic processes in the brain. And I was very excited by findings in the lab, how we found that the blood proteins in the brain can actually suppress remyelination and regeneration in the CNS, giving us a whole new way of thinking about the problem of how to protect the brain from toxic inflammation.
What do you see as the next step, perhaps even the next frontier in MS research that's going to potentially transform treatment, perhaps even bring us closer to one of the Pathways to Cure's goals?
Yeah, I think that there are many exciting discoveries on brain-body communication that I think will be really important for our understanding for multiple sclerosis, both at the level of prevention very early on to find what happens before the disease even starts, but also at the level of stopping the disease later in its progression.
Professor Katerina Akasoglu, thank you for all the work you do to improve the lives of people living with MS, and thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Dwight Burgles of Johns Hopkins University received the Brancic Prize in 2020 in recognition of his pioneering research in understanding the brain cells involved in myelin repair. In a moment, we'll meet Dr. Burgles. Dr. Dwight Burgles is a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And to put it succinctly, virtually all of the research on myelin repair that's taking place today is based on Dr. Burgles' foundational research in understanding the brain cells that repair myelin. Dr. Burgles is a director of the Kavli Neuroscience Discovery Institute, and he also serves as the vice chair of research and director of the Multiphoton Imaging and Electrophysiology Corps at the Solomon H. Snyder Department of Neuroscience. Dr. Burgles is the 2020 recipient of the Barancic Prize for Innovation in MS Research, awarded in recognition of his pioneering work in understanding the brain cells involved in myelin repair. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Burgles.
Thanks, John. You very accurately sort of like illustrated the many hats that I'm wearing now. This happens.
You know, MS is described as a demyelinating disease, and most people living with MS have had demyelination explained as a process similar to stripping the protective insulation away from an electrical cord. Now, in the case of MS, that actual electrical cord is a nerve in the central nervous system, and when that myelin gets stripped away, that nerve has greater and greater difficulty trying to pass along communication, and that faulty communication leads to disability. So do we know what keeps remyelination from happening naturally?
That's a great question. We know in the developing nervous system that the process of myelination involves the sort of, let's say, recruitment or the mobilization of progenitor cells. So these are cells that have the ability to divide, and they then will undergo differentiation where they become a cell which is really devoted to creating that insulating sheath of myelin. Now, in the case of MS, what happens is that these progenitor cells, which remarkably continue to exist in the adult nervous system, so it's one of the few examples of, you know, repair in the nervous system. Most people are, who are familiar with the nervous system, it's thought that it has a limited capacity for repair. You know, that basically you're born with all of the nerve cells you'll ever have, and you can't ever get more. Well, the exception to that is that if you consider these other cell types, nerve cells, is that we have the ability to restore these oligodendrocytes, which give rise to myelin, through mobilization of these progenitor cells. So in the adult brain, we have many, many of these progenitor cells. It's actually fascinating. If you look into the brain, you can see that these cells form almost like a grid or a tiled array in the nervous system. There really isn't an area of the nervous system where these progenitors aren't found. So if you think about, being, let's say, optimistic about repair, this is almost like an ideal situation because, you know, you have the progenitor cells in your brain. They're found everywhere. And we know that these cells have the ability to become oligodendrocytes. So the challenge is that what we find is that these cells don't readily become oligodendrocytes anymore in MS. And so that is what we're trying to understand, is why these cells, which still exist, are not mobilized effectively.
What are some of the latest discoveries around myelin repair that get you excited?
One of the things that that gets me excited, of course, our research focuses on these progenitor cells and the oligodendrocytes and that process. So it's really the repair of myelin process that we're interested in. And one of the exciting discoveries is that the oligodendrocyte precursor cells, these progenitors, are actually multifunctional cells in the nervous system. So you might think that, you know, a progenitor cell might have an exclusive function. That is, its sole purpose in life is to become an oligodendrocyte. And it waits until the signals are there, which tell it, you know, green light, let's go, let's differentiate and make a new oligodendrocyte. But what happens if this person has other jobs that it has to do at the same time? So it turns out that these progenitor cells are really involved in other things in the nervous system. They have the ability to sort of trim away processes of neurons during development to sort of sculpt the ultimate circuit that's formed in the nervous system. And they can do that literally by like chewing bits and pieces of neurons off and we call it engulfment. And so one of the discoveries that's come out in the last couple of years is that these cells that we thought were kind of exclusively progenitor cells are actually cells that are also involved in remodeling and restoring the environment. And so why I think that this is very exciting for MS is it suggests that they might be in a situation where they're conflicted, let's say, where they might think, well, I have to be doing this job over here, which is different from the job of making an oligodendrocyte. And so what we're trying to understand now is there a way that we can pull these cells back, make them more willing to undergo differentiation and make oligodendrocytes? Because it could be that they're just kind of pushed away down a different road and need to be brought back in. And so I think that is very exciting, this recognition that they have other roles in the nervous system. And if we can understand what moves them in that direction, we might be able to pull them back and make them be able to differentiate more readily.
To a lot of people living with MS, especially those who have experienced some disease progression, a quote-unquote cure means going back to a time when they had the physical functionality that they no longer have. What would you say to those people whose hopes for a cure are focused on being able to repair myelin damage and restore that lost function?
I think this is a great question. And, you know, one of the challenges that we face in MS is it's a disease that happens over many decades. And so the aging process happens as well. We would all love to be 15 again and be invincible and have, you know, that youthful vigor. But the reality is that, you know, we're all aging even without disease. So I think the challenge is to understand how the nervous system ages and how we can design therapies that are appropriate for a particular age. So it's possible that a therapy in a young individual could be effective, but not effective in an older individual, things like that, or a therapy that's tailored to an older individual wouldn't be appropriate for a younger individual. So I think that a lot about, you know, a cure being very directed to the stage of disease, the age of the individual, the genetic background of the individual, the sex of the individual, all these kinds of things to develop more like personalized, therapy. And we are going in that direction now as we understand more and more about the disease. And that really, I think, will bode well. It's not going to be one size fits all. It's very likely, you know, if I had to like distill it down, I would say I think it's probably going to be at a minimum kind of a three-tiered process where the first is obviously to prevent the immune system from attacking and destroying the oligodendrocytes because they're the ones that give rise to the myelin. And if those cells die, then you'll have this problem of, you know, the neurons are not communicating appropriately with each other anymore. So I think blocking that effect is probably the first step. The second step would be to protect the oligodendrocytes and the neurons that are still there. They might be more vulnerable now that they've been maybe slightly damaged by the inflammation or the influx of immune cells, things like that. So we want to protect. We don't want any more cells to die. Let's say that. So that's the second step. And third step is really repair. How can we then regenerate the oligodendrocytes to restore the myelin sheath and restore the appropriate connectivity, which is necessary for these circuits to function optimally and process information in the way that they were designed?
We're here at the ACTRIMS Forum in part to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Boransic Prize. It's an award that recognizes innovation in MS research. So how do you define that term, innovation in MS research? What does it mean to you?
For me, it's really about developing new methodologies that allow us to gain insight into a disease process or a repair process. In practical terms, because the work that we do involves studies of individual progenitor cells in the intact nervous system, we're usually deploying new advances in genetics, in engineering, in physics, in computer science, sort of like taking the knowledge and the advances in those fields and applying them to this specific question. So this is really what innovation is, I believe. It's sort of like being aware of what's happening in other fields and the advances that they're making and either sort of like assimilating or convincing those people to apply their knowledge to your particular problem. So I think, this is a big part of what innovation is. And it, you know, in some ways it's you know, you've got to be a very convincing individual to do this. You really have to, you know, you have to convince people to spend their time and their energy on your problem. There's many, many, you know, people have many, many, you know, sort of like questions that they're trying to answer and things like that. So one of the, I think the things that, that is so important is to be a, to be a convincing person, you know, to be able to, negotiate and motivate people to focus their energies on this particular disease.
Well, Dr. Dwight Burgles, thank you for all you do to improve and impact the lives of people who are living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, John. It's a delight to be here.
At this year's ACTRIMS Forum, Dr. Ruth Ann Mary of the University of Manitoba was awarded the 2022 Baranczyk Prize in recognition of her many groundbreaking contributions to the understanding of MS. In a moment, we'll meet Dr. Mary. This year's recipient of the Baranczyk Prize for Innovation in MS Research is Dr. Ruth Ann Mary. Dr. Mary is a professor of medicine and community health sciences at the University of Manitoba in Canada and the director of the Multiple Sclerosis Clinic at Health Sciences Center Winnipeg. Dr. Mary's award recognizes her many groundbreaking contributions to our understanding of MS. In 2010, Dr. Mary published the first report suggesting that other health conditions like diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, or high cholesterol could increase disease progression and disability in people living with MS. Since that initial study, Dr. Mary and her team have shown that various comorbidities or other health conditions actually affect all aspects of MS, including time to diagnosis, severity of disability at diagnosis, the use of healthcare, relapse rates, and mortality. In 2012, Dr. Mary published a landmark paper showing that people with MS increased their use of healthcare through visits to the doctor during the 5 years before the first symptoms of MS occurred. Dr. Mary's work in this area has led to the recognition of the prodromal phase of MS, which is something we've discussed on previous episodes of the podcast. And as researchers learn more about the MS prodrome, it could lead to a time when early intervention, before even the first typical symptom of MS has occurred, could lead to preventing MS from ever developing. Dr. Mary is a co-author of the Pathways to Cures Research Roadmap. She serves as the vice chair of the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Steering Committee, as well as the scientific director of the NARCOMS Registry. First, congratulations on being named this year's winner of a very well-deserved award, and welcome to the podcast, Dr. Mary.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what was it that first got you interested in MS research?
Well, I was really fortunate when I was a neurology resident at McGill to have a program that expected us to do 6 months of research. And unlike some of my colleagues who wanted to go and look at MRIs for hours on end or, you know, work in a lab with pipettes and things, that wasn't really my interest. When I had been a medical student, I'd had the opportunity to work in an area of epidemiology. So just trying to understand risk factors for disease, you know, who gets it and how often. So I essentially found the only neuroepidemiologist at the time at McGill who agreed to take me on as a student. And she had a couple of choices of projects. And the one on MS sounded more interesting to me. It was about Epstein-Barr virus, which is a popular topic these days. And so as part of that, I really had to do a lot of reading to make sure I could really execute the project and really take ownership of it. And realized in the course of that that I was quite interested in what I was learning about, and I hadn't had much exposure to MS at that point because I was doing mostly inpatient care. And so got permission to spend half a day a week in the multiple sclerosis clinic throughout that rotation. And by the end of that time, the clinical exposure and the research exposure really cemented for me that that's where I wanted to be.
As I mentioned a moment ago, one of the areas that your research is focused on is how other health conditions called comorbidities impact virtually every aspect of MS. As people age, it becomes more and more likely that they'll develop some other health conditions. So it's not an uncommon situation. I have a two-part question here. Do comorbidities themselves worsen MS in an individual? And does having other health conditions, these comorbidities, make treating MS more complicated?
Yeah, so I think those are both important questions that we deal with in the clinic every day. And so what we have found, and now others have replicated, is that having other health conditions is associated with MS being worse. And we can think about that from a few perspectives. One is, relapses. So we see higher relapse rates when people have more coexisting conditions, in particular if they have high cholesterol. We often notice a lot when people have difficulty with their mobility. And so that's something where we see progression of those kinds of impairments is faster when people have more physical comorbid conditions, but also when they have depression and anxiety. We see more changes on MRI as well with health conditions. And then when we think about cognition, so our ability to think and remember, which is really important to people with MS, we also know that those coexisting conditions are associated with worsening in that way. And so it gets more complicated still when we start to think about treatment. Why? Well, I need to be thinking about the MS-specific treatment. We need to make sure that those coexisting conditions are taken care of. But also because some of our therapies may increase the risk of developing coexisting conditions, and because some of the medications that we use to treat the coexisting conditions are things that don't mix well with our disease-modifying therapies. And so that means that you need to be thinking about the choice of MS-specific therapies in the context of all of the other issues that that person with MS has.
I've always had a particular interest in your research in identifying and better understanding the prodromal phase of MS. I'm hoping you'll explain to our listeners what the prodromal phase of MS is and how being able to identify it in someone might lead to preventing MS from developing.
Sure. So I think we can start with an example that might be more common for people to see. So many of us know somebody with migraine headaches because it's so common in the general population. And so a lot of people with migraine, before they get that really blinding pain in their head and the sensitivity to the lights and sound, have some non-specific symptoms that constitute their prodrome, like a change in appetite or thirst or just being kind of grumpy and tired. But it's kind of a warning that the headache is coming. So with multiple sclerosis, we now recognize that before people have those first really specific symptoms we recognize with MS, like the visual loss and the eye pain that represents optic neuritis, is that there are non-specific symptoms that precede that. So we are beginning to see that it's things like, you know, fatigue and perhaps depression, anxiety, and those kinds of pieces that precede it. And the real value in that is that's maybe our opportunity to intervene and do something to prevent those more problematic and highly typical specific symptoms forever developing. So thinking about it as a prevention exercise so that we stop it, and then maybe you don't have to go through all the disease modifying therapies and all the consequences that we currently recognize as having MS. So I think it's a golden opportunity.
I agree. You're the vice chair of the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Steering Committee, as well as a co-author of the Pathways to Cures Research Roadmap. Both of these really important, significant initiatives leverage scientific collaboration on a global level. Why is that important in moving MS research forward?
Well, MS is complicated. I think we all know that. It may seem obvious, but when you have a complicated problem, you really want all the smartest people in the room working together. What happens if you don't? Well, maybe you have four people working on the same piece of the pie, right? The same part of the project. And maybe they're all stumbling along more slowly because they're all figuring things out from scratch. Well, if we work together, then maybe what we can do is have one person working on one piece and the other people can spread out and work out on the other missing pieces. And I can share what I've learned so that you can do it better and can build on what I've done instead of starting from scratch. And so that allows us to move ahead much more quickly. And we need to do that because there are so many complexities. We really need the most rigorous science from wherever it is in the world to move forward as quickly as possible so we can get to those pathways and to the actual cures that we want in each of those areas.
The very first time that you and I talked was when the work that you led in the prevalence of MS in the U.S. was published. Now there's been additional work done on kind of fine-tuning what we know about the prevalence of MS in the United States. I'm hoping you can first explain the methodology behind this study and then share some of the more nuanced, detailed findings.
Sure. So first, when we're thinking about prevalence of MS, really what we're talking about is counting the number of people with MS in the population. So when we think about per capita numbers, right? So then the question is, how do we do that? So old-fashioned ways, when you have small pieces of the world to look at, like a county, for example, are to knock on the door and ask, do a survey or look at medical records from everybody in a region. It's not a realistic strategy for a large country like the United States. But what happens? Most people go to doctors and go to hospitals, and there are records that are gathered as a part of those encounters. And so researchers can access those kinds of data, which are called administrative or health claims data. So then there's the next problem with the fact that the United States does not have a single health system. So people may be getting health care through the Veterans Health Administration, or they might be getting it paid for through Medicare or Medicaid or through a commercial health organization. So what we thought about was that people must exist, for the most part, in at least one of those pools. So what we could do is develop a strategy to identify people with MS in each of those pools. So first, we developed essentially an algorithm. So how many times did people with MS have to get health care where somebody wrote a diagnosis of MS as part of their billing to the health insurer before we could be confident they had MS? So we did that work in Veterans Health Administration, Kaiser Permanente in Canada, and showed that actually the same rule worked everywhere, which made us feel more confident about it. So you need to have sort of at least three of those healthcare contacts. And then we could apply it to a series of data sets. So we could identify all the people with MS within the Veterans Health Administration and all the people within Medicare and all the people within Medicaid and then within a couple of different commercial health organizations. So then what we needed to do is figure out, well, what percentage of the American population gets their care within the VA or Medicare or Medicaid. So I could then take that percentage and multiply it by the number of people in that particular insurance pool. And I can add them all up now. And then that allows me to get a total number of people with MS in the United States. And then I could go back and say, well, what's the population of the United States? And I can put one number on top of the other. And now I can come up with that per capita number. Once you've got that, you can use that same approach to figure out how the numbers differ by whether you're male or female or where you live in a particular state or by race or ethnicity. So it gives us lots of opportunity to try and really understand prevalence better.
Can you share any insights into what some of the more recent calculations told us?
Sure. So we've been really trying to understand more in particular about race and ethnicity in terms of the prevalence of MS. So there's a lot of historical views about who was at most risk of getting multiple sclerosis. So really often people thought of people who self-identify as white and of European ancestry. And people really didn't think that MS was very common in people who identified as, you know, African-American, Black. And so the work that we've done has told us that actually people who identify as African-American or Black are almost as likely as people who identify as white to have MS. And so that's a really big shift from thinking it's uncommon to thinking it's just as common. And then when we looked at Hispanic ethnicity, we saw that the likelihood of MS was lower in people who identified as Hispanic, but it's not low when you consider the world region that we live in, where we have a pretty high prevalence. And so these are really important things to help us think differently when people come in with neurologic symptoms and they might not be in the racial or ethnic group that we traditionally have thought about as being at risk. So it's really important not to miss people because we have those kind of preconceived notions.
Those preconceived notions too often historically have become barriers to access to care, where people either spend years not being able to get a diagnosis, or even when they get a diagnosis are told, well, that can't be right because MS only affects white people. So this is really important information for clinicians to have everywhere.
I agree. I mean, I think this is, you know, whenever somebody doesn't come in with kind of the traditional appearance of whatever disease, this is a challenge that they face. And so the diagnostic delays, of course, we know affect long-term outcomes in multiple sclerosis. And so I think, you know, an important piece is that we need to make sure that clinicians at all stages get this information. So it's not just when you get to the MS specialist, it's the person who's doing the referral to the neurologist in the first place. It's the person themselves thinking that maybe they have a condition that might be MS and advocating. And so going to their doctor and then getting their primary care doctor to do the referral and sort of moving down the line. So we have a lot of people who need to know this information, easier to get it out to the neurologist, but we need all of the people who are involved in that healthcare pathway to be aware.
Well, Dr. Ruth Ann Mary, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. Congratulations once again on being named this year's recipient of the Brancic Prize for Innovation in MS Research. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Having the honor of talking with five Brancic Prize winners was a rare and wonderful opportunity for me. I hope that listening to their impressions of what innovation in MS research means and the MS research that has them most excited about the future has given you a glimpse into how these remarkable scientists perceive the MS research landscape. I hope you'll continue to join me in our exploration of that landscape every week on Real Talk MS. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.